Hello everyone, welcome to the end of June. I don't know what it's like in your part of the world, but things are starting to get very warm here. A little warmer than I like, but what are you going to do? We've had a number of interesting questions and comments come through. They work well as a group together, so we'll get down to that soon. As always, thanks to anyone who has sent in a note of appreciation. As always, thank you to Marcus Fellows for establishing this website and for posting these responses to the questions. Usually I respond to these questions in the order in which they were sent in. This time I would like to rearrange them a bit because there's one question which would allow me to establish a certain context for what we might loosely call this non-dual perspective, a context that I feel is quite important. So we'll start with that particular question. And that question reads, "Dear Daryl, thank you so much for your website and your three books. I have read Dismantling the Fantasy many times, and over the weekend finished Essence Revisited, which I found extraordinarily illuminating, a really special book. My question is about the seeming contradiction between non-duality teachings and those of classical Buddhism. Over the last 25 years or so, my mind has veered from one to the other, and my burning question has always been regarding responsibility, karma, and free will, and my understanding that the Buddha advised training the mind and the four right efforts and about intended actions leading to rebirth, etc. Yet when I closely observe my experience, I can clearly see that all of my thoughts just come to me. I do not choose or direct any of them, and from thoughts come actions. So how can I be responsible for my actions? How can the quote from the Pali Canon, 'I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, etc.,' be true? Why did the Buddha say that happiness comes from training the mind? You seem to address this issue so well, and your words seem to express my experience, but your perspective and that of non-duality is at variance with the Buddha's as recorded in the early scriptures. I would be so grateful for your comments." So I'm sure that any of us who have had an interest in traditional scriptures have been struck by the conflict of certain apparent views within those scriptures. It's not just existing within the Buddhist scriptures, it's in all of the traditional scriptures that I know of. There seems to be this contradiction of views. You can look at some of these, the portions of these scriptures, and one portion will be talking about or speaking about cultivating certain abilities, cultivating concentration, cultivating feelings of kindness, the cultivation of certain sympathies for other people, empathy. And then you have other portions of the scripture which simply state outright that there isn't any you here to do anything, that everything is either an expression of the universe or an expression of God, or in the case of Buddhism, the expression of the asankhata, the unformed. So you have this very obvious contradiction. If there is only the action of God, or the movement of God, or there is only God, or there is only the Great Spirit, or there is only the asankhata, or there is only the movement of nature, why in heaven's name are we are we trying to cultivate anything in particular? Or why are we led to believe that working hard to restrain defilements is somehow going to lead us to enlightenment? So just to clarify this particular contradiction, it's true that there were statements in the Buddhist scriptures that basically had the Buddha saying, I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions. And he was wanting people to realize somehow in that statement that they were responsible for their actions. And he did say that somehow happiness comes from training the mind, the cultivation of the mind. I believe the Pali word for that was bhavana, if I remember correctly. And yet at the same time, you would find a statement such as the following. Let me see if I can find this. Perceiving impermanence in all formations, and all formations will be seen as insubstantial. Everything is changing. There is an unformed. With the mind perceiving impermanence, it does not reach for gain. With the mind perceiving no true formation, no mentality, and no physicality, it is rid of the fantasies of I and mine, this body and consciousness. One who has come to what is freed from measuring in terms of physical forms, feelings, perceptions, mental activities, and states of consciousness, and lives beyond measure, beyond explanation. One who has come to what actually is cannot be regarded as existing. How can you talk of existence or non-existence after death? Descriptions do not apply. Quite obviously, that's a very different teaching to the one that says you are responsible for your actions and you have to work very hard in order to reach some kind of freedom. We can also find that same inherent conflict in something like Christianity. So most of us have probably had a teaching from Christianity saying that we really have to endeavor to lead a good life in order that we may enter the kingdom of heaven after we die. But actually, if we read the Bible, we also find statements such as the following. Many are the plans in a man's heart, but it is God's purpose that will prevail. A man plans, but God determines his steps. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing can be taken away. Man's life is not his own. Man does not direct his own steps. You cannot make even one hair white or black. I, God, am the Lord, and there is no other. I create light, darkness, peace, and evil. I do all these things. Who can straighten what God has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this, God has made one as well as the other. A man's steps are directed by the Lord. How can anyone understand his own way? The wind blows wherever it blows. You cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. It is the same for everyone born of spirit. God gives all men life and breath and everything else. We can also look at something like the Bhagavad Gita, which is, these days, it's one of the main scriptures of the yoga traditions. So most of the Bhagavad Gita is telling you that you really have to work hard and diligently and always be on guard to overcome your defilements. And yet they have portions of the Gita saying things like your intention will be in vain because nature will compel you to act in whatever way you act. The things that you wish not to do, you will do, even against your will. And then it goes on to say that God dwells deep in the heart of all beings, making them revolve like puppets. So again, you have this contradiction. On one hand, they're telling you that you have to work really hard in order to overcome all kinds of human frailties and human defilements. And at the same time, they're telling you that there is only God, that nobody else is doing anything. Early Taoism was very clear that everything was simply a movement of nature, that there was no self separate from that movement of nature. There wasn't anybody responsible for any of their actions. And yet modern day Taoism has all kinds of magical practices that they ask you to put your time and energy in order to gain control of life in many different ways. even within the realms of modern science, where we get the impression that people are learning about existence in order to gain some kind of control, we have people like Albert Einstein in his free time going around giving talks to people and saying things like, and I quote, "Everything is determined by forces over which we have no control. It is determined for the insect as well as the star. Human beings, vegetables, or cosmic dust, we all dance to a mysterious tune." That's something he wrote in the Saturday Evening Post. And in a talk to the American Spinoza Society, he made the declaration that our actions should be based on the ever-present awareness that human beings in their thinking, feeling, and acting are not free, but are just as causally bound as the stars in their motion. As far as any collection of traditional scriptures goes, I would say don't try to find any kind of clarity within those scriptures, because any group of scriptures, any collection of scriptures from any particular spiritual tradition will contain any number of conflicting views. And there's no way to sort them out by reading that book of scriptures. Reading the scriptures simply reveals that it contains all kinds of conflicted views. And many people have had many ways of expressing why that's so. One of the approaches is to say that, well, these scriptures were compiled over many centuries by many people, and these various people had their various understandings, and from those different understandings of the scriptures came these different views. An example in Buddhism might be that in the very early Buddhist scriptures, the teaching, the rebirth teaching, was laid out in a way that appeared to be a psychological development, and only a few pages might be interpreted as being a reincarnation teaching. And yet, 1,000 years later, in Sri Lanka, a very famous monk named Buddhaghosa put together a book called The Path to Purification, and in that book he reversed the sense of the rebirth teaching, so that in that book he related most of the teaching as a reincarnation teaching, and in only a few passages he related it as a psychological development. So you have that kind of thing that's going on in the evolution of these spiritual traditions. Another approach to explaining this has been that the founders of these traditions had a very profound understanding of existence, and so they would give this profound teaching. A profound teaching that would say, you know, perhaps there is only the movement of nature, there is only God, there is only the unformed, the great spirit, however they expressed it. They would ultimately be saying that there is only this indefinable event doing what it does, and that all the stories of human beings and a world and all the rest of it, that this is somehow a fantasy. But people will say that these founders, once they had given this very profound teaching, they would often realize that very few people actually had the ability to relate to that very profound teaching, so they would give a lesser teaching, a more worldly teaching. And in that teaching, they would lay out certain rules of morality, they would lay out certain practices for the average person to involve themselves with in developing a better way of living. In any event, you have these contradictions within any group of scriptures, within in any collection of scriptures, within any particular tradition. And you cannot find any resolution of those conflicted views by reading those scriptures. You can only find a resolution of this through your own experience. The Buddha at one point was asked by a number of people, like, what are we supposed to believe? Like, we have this one great teacher coming through and they say this, and, you know, we read something somewhere, and or I guess they wouldn't be reading anything at that time. It was an oral tradition. So we hear something from another teacher and they seem to be saying something different, and it all gets very confusing. So what are we supposed to believe? So the Buddha gave a very well-known teaching. It's come to be a very famous teaching, in which case he said to these people, look, sit down and have a look at your life, and what you see to be the truth, each and every time you sit down and look at your life, believe that. Believe your own experience. And ultimately, this, what we call, loosely call, a non-dual perspective, is to be seen in our own experience, the happening of this moment, the actual happening of what we call life. And from that approach, from simply acknowledging what's actually happening in this moment, from our experience, we may arrive at what can be loosely called a non-dual perspective. But that non-dual perspective really isn't a perspective per se, because ultimately it simply ends up realizing that the event of this moment, everything that is apparently happening in this moment, is a totally unexplainable, formless dance of apparent events that cannot be explained in any way whatsoever. So from a non-dual perspective, you can't come to the truest perspective. You can't come to the correct view as opposed to all of the incorrect views. And from that realization, we may see that a collection of scriptural teachings is not presenting one particular view, it's presenting every possible view, because from this non-dual realization, we have this event that is endlessly expressing itself in ongoing creative expressions. The apparent forms that are passing by are unique. They're constantly moving to apparent diversity and then melting away. So from that realization, any scriptural teaching will be presenting an endless diversity of views and will not be expressing any particular correct view any more than nature expresses any particular expression. So you can't say that one snowflake is doing it right and other snowflakes are doing it wrong. You can't say that the trees are doing it right and the snowflakes are doing it wrong. You can't say that any particular human being is the right expression of existence as opposed to all the other human beings. You can't say that all the other human beings are the wrong expressions of existence. Everything is the right expression of existence. And that expression is ultimately indefinable. It has no particular form. It can't be explained in any way whatsoever. Ultimately, all that can happen is that you point to an event that can't really be described in any way at all. So this particular realization is loosely called a non-dual perspective, but even that is not considered to be the one correct view. It's just one of the expressions of existence. So in this so-called spiritual quest that we seem to go on, it's not a matter of seeking out the one correct view of existence, because there isn't any one correct view of existence. It's simply a matter that you will be expressed in whatever way you're expressed, and you will apparently come to the sense of existence that makes the most sense to you. You will come to a view of existence that makes the most sense to you. It doesn't need to be the one correct view of existence, because there isn't any particularly correct view of existence. There are simply the many apparently varied expressions of existence. So there's no problem in all of these contradictory views, because on any given day, at any given moment, any apparent day, any apparent moment, only certain things will make sense to you. And that is the expression of this great mysterious event. You cannot come to see this or realize this by reading a book of scriptures. It can only be realized through a simple acknowledgement of this moment and how this moment expresses itself. And as this questioner has pointed out, in her actual experience, her thoughts simply come on their own. So in that actual experience, I mean, this is our conundrum, and this is the absurdity of our relationship or our so-called attachment to thought, is that we will tend to believe somebody else's writing more than we believe our actual experience. So for any one of us, if we're looking to reconcile these conflicted views within any of these particular traditions, it can only be reconciled through a simple acknowledgement of this moment and how it presents itself. And perhaps it will move to what might be called, loosely called, a non-dual perspective. Maybe not. However it moves is fine, because from this non-dual perspective, there is only the expression of existence. There is only the expression of nature. Call it the Great Spirit. Call it God. Call it the unformed, the Asankhata. Call it Atman. These words simply point to this mysterious happening. The next person has written in saying, "All of you talk as if this is applicable to everyone." "I read Dismantling the Fantasy and nothing happened." "Writers think their books are the best." Well, it wasn't applicable. And then this same person wrote in a little while later and said, "Some people have difficult problems. Why do you lump everything in the same heap?" I should point out, when I laugh or have a chuckle about some of this, I'm not laughing at anybody's particular approach. I'm simply, I can't help but laugh at just the situation we're all in. Life can be very confusing at times, and it presents all kinds of confusing situations and all kinds of desires. So, you know, let's look at these comments. The first line of this message says, "All of you talk as if this is applicable to everyone." Well, I don't talk as if this is applicable to everyone. There are many times that I say, this perspective is only for those who relate to it. And if you don't relate to it, that's perfectly fine, because this is not the one correct view of existence. This is not the one correct expression of existence. This is just one of the many expressions of existence. If you relate to it, that's wonderful. And if you don't relate to it, that's wonderful. Either way is fine. If you don't relate to this perspective, there will be some perspective in life that you relate to. As far as I'm concerned, there isn't any one perspective that's better than any other. So this person has gone on to say, "I read Dismantling the Fantasy and nothing happened." That's fine. That's perfectly fine. If you don't relate to it, you don't relate to it. It's not necessary that you relate to it. Lots of people lead their lives without having a non-dual perspective, and they're quite happy with their lives. There are other apparent things that are more meaningful to them, and those apparent things supply the meaning to their life. This person goes on to say, writers think their books are the best. Well, this one's not applicable. So I don't think my books are the best. My books are simply some of the many apparent expressions of existence. The whole thing is a totally mysterious dance to me. And in no way do I feel that my perspective is better than anyone else's. However, there is the realization that there are those who there are apparently those who relate very strongly to this perspective that I'm offering, and it is for those that this perspective is offered. And this person concludes by saying, some people have very difficult problems. Why do you lump everything in the same heap? I don't lump everything in the same heap. Within, for me, it's just simply a fact that there is ultimately only a totally indefinable, formless event presenting itself. Now, within that indefinable, formless event, or as some aspect of this indefinable, formless event, we have many apparent expressions. And as far as what I'm saying about that, I'm saying that absolutely each and every apparent expression of this indefinable event, each and every apparent expression is unique. There is no possible way that any expression can be identical to any other. The whole idea that we're going to somehow gather together, hold hands, and sing the same song of love and peace makes no sense to me. I don't think that blue jays and sparrows are going to hang out together any more than I think various apparent people with their various apparent views are going to end up all hanging out together. So a third person has written in saying, Daryl, you talk about life as a seamless movement or happening. You don't seem to talk much about awareness. I don't even remember if the word is ever used in your books. Many teachings emphasize the awareness in which everything appears. The appearance is ever-changing, and the awareness is ever-present. The appearance is flux and change. The awareness is the still point of here and now, beholding it all. Many teachings emphasize a shift from being absorbed in the content of thoughts and stories to being simply present as awareness. It is often pointed out that awareness is always present, even when there are stories and thoughts and mental confusion, so that this is not so much a shift to awareness as it is simply a recognition of what is already present, what is already always present. The me who seems to be shifting is seen to be only a thought story. In some teachings, there is a kind of dualistic split between awareness and everything that shows up in awareness, as if awareness was something separate and detached, standing apart from life. That is clearly a false or partial understanding. But other teachings emphasize that there is no separation between awareness and content, just as there is no separation between water and its waves. And yet these teachings still seem to put importance on this recognition. But I find many people get caught up in trying to be awareness or identify as awareness, or else they get some idea of a transcendent something that is beyond everything else. Can you comment on this? Actually, before I comment on that, this person has also added that in my own experience, recognizing everything as movement or formlessness and recognizing awareness as the water that has these waves are just different ways of pointing out and conceptualizing the same shift from a sense of separation to a sense of wholeness, a shift that also includes the recognition that even this apparent shifting is just another waving of the ocean. So I would just like to say yes to all of that. But we'll go through it point by point. Daryl, you talk about life as a seamless movement or happening. You don't seem to talk much about awareness. I don't even remember if the word is ever used in your books. So, yes, that's true. I don't use the word awareness very much. I rarely use it. And the reason for that is there isn't any awareness. Awareness is a meaningless word. It simply points to an event that can't be explained in any way whatsoever. So, from my sense of things, I don't see the point in getting people to believe that there's somehow something called awareness. Ultimately, you'll have to move them out of that belief, as well as any other belief. So, as this person points out, many teachings will say that we're not the things that we see, we're the awareness of those things. And they will attempt to get us to accept that we're this something that's not quite the things that we see, the movement and the change, that we are the I don't know what you would call it, the space or whatever that houses all of this, all of these apparent things that are moving and shifting and changing. And that's our real identity. So, as this person points out, in some of those teachings, there's a kind of dualistic split between awareness and everything that shows up in awareness, as though awareness was something separate and detached. But then there are other teachings that say there is no separation between awareness and its content, so those various things that are passing by, and that the awareness is like the ocean and the various things are the waves in the ocean. So these things that are moving and shifting and changing are simply aspects of this ocean of awareness. So I would agree with this person that the sense that awareness is something separate from all of the various things in life, this isn't backed up in our experience, that it is, you could say it's closer to the notion that awareness is really the big event that contains all of these things, but I'm simply pointing out that even that is false. And there are a lot of teachers who get caught up in this notion of awareness. So the one that jumps to mind immediately is Nisargadatta Maharaj, who just before he died pointed out that for most of his teaching career, he had been teaching that everyone is fundamentally pure consciousness, and that he himself believed himself to be this pure consciousness. But then, in a short time before he died, he had the realization that even that was a misguided conception, that to be stuck on notions of pure awareness or pure consciousness was still living in delusion, was still living in concepts that were incorrect. Once again, to resolve any of this, we really have to consider the event of this moment. So, you know, we have this happening of this moment, and loosely we will relate to it as you know, basic consciousness. We would say it's seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking. And so we break up this basic happening that we label as basic consciousness into these various portions. So if we really want to examine this in any detail, we could take one of these apparent portions of this basic consciousness. So we can take this happening that we call seeing. So in this moment, there's a happening that we call seeing. Now, it's quite a simple thing to acknowledge the event that we call seeing. It's just this happening that we call seeing. Now, at the same time, you know, so that's the entire event that we call seeing. Now, if the focus shifts to some apparent form within that field happening that we call awareness, if the focus shifts to some apparent form within that field, we now say that we're looking at an object of seeing, that there is an object of seeing. So, you know, maybe we see a watch or a chair or a clock or whatever. There's a focus on that form, and we say that's an the object of seeing. So there's something odd in that, because it's the same basic happening. In one moment, we're calling it seeing, which is just basic consciousness, and in the next moment, we're calling it an object of consciousness, or an object of seeing, but it's the same basic happening. And what's even more strange is that we add to that the notion that there is an awareness somewhere looking out at this object of awareness, this object of seeing. So we have the impression that there's an awareness inside our so-called head looking out the eyes to see this object of seeing, when in fact no one ever has any experience of an awareness looking out at something. It's quite apparent that there is this happening that we call seeing, and it's quite apparent that when the focus shifts to a particular form within that field of seeing, that we then call that an object of seeing. But none of us has an experience of anything looking out at that. There is just this happening that we call seeing and an object of seeing. I remember that Douglas Harding, in his experiments of exploring the moment, had this great little experiment where if you took a paper bag, maybe a foot deep, and if that paper bag was, the opening of that paper bag was big enough to fit over your face, what he would ask you to do is cut out the bottom of the paper bag. And if you don't have a paper bag, you could just take a strip of paper that's a foot wide and maybe a couple of feet long and join the long ends so that it creates a kind of tube, and one end of it fits over your face so that you're looking down this tube that's 1 foot long, and you have this open end at the other end of the tube. And then look at something. So, quite obviously, we're looking down this tube, or it seems like we're looking down this tube, and we're looking at an object. So, Douglas Harding would then ask people to bring the attention back to the edge of the bag, or the edge of the tube, and then follow the edges of that tube back toward your apparent face, and come back as far as you can, and it will become very apparent that there you don't have any experience of something at this end looking out. There is just this event of seeing. No one has any experience of anything looking out at this event of seeing, or anything doing this event of seeing, and it's the same with all the other senses. There is the hearing, and then within that, the focus goes on certain apparent sound forms, and those become objects of hearing, but there's no experience of anything doing the hearing. There's just this event called hearing, and so it is with all the other senses. All the various teachers of a so-called non-dual perspective point to this in their various ways. So Jiddu Krishnamurti would always say, the observer is the observed. Now, he wasn't saying that if you were looking at a tree, you are the tree, that there's a you that somehow is the tree. He's just saying there is only this happening that we call seeing a tree. There is only this observed. There isn't any observer. So there, that was his way of pointing to this event that's just an undivided event. Even this basic sense of consciousness that conceptually gets divided up into notions of seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking, that's an undivided event. It's simply the happening of now. It isn't seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking. These are meaningless sounds, simply pointing to an event that can't be explained in any way whatsoever. Now, some teachers will ask us to realize that we are the awareness of the moment. So, in a way, it's like saying that simply we are the seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking, but we're not anything that's doing that. So to simplify it, they simply say we are this basic consciousness, this most basic sense of being conscious, this most basic sense of being aware. And they come up with a special term for that. They call it pure consciousness or pure awareness. So really it's getting the attention to draw back or to acknowledge the large event of the moment. So, you know, you can do it by saying we are the basic awareness, or you could say we are the basic, or you could say there is simply this basic happening of the moment. Either one is fine. Whatever one you are apparently drawn to is fine, but from my perspective, from my sense of things, I don't see the relevance of getting anyone to believe that there's something called awareness, or the purpose of emphasizing that this big mysterious happening of this moment, this undivided happening, this formless swirl of this moment, I don't see the point of emphasizing that that's something called awareness. There's no way of saying what any of this is. Again, my particular approach to this is not the one true approach. It's just one of the many expressions of existence. There isn't any particular apparent approach or any particular apparent perspective that is the one true perspective. All of this is a totally inexplicable event. And the point of this is not, the point of a non-dual teaching is not really to get everybody to come to the same perspective. It's simply acknowledging that everyone is a unique expression of this basic mysterious happening. And really, whatever you're apparently drawn to is just fine, because all of it is a totally mysterious event expressing itself. There isn't anyone influencing its movement or its expression. It seems that maybe the most fundamentally accepted approach to all of this is just you sit down, you do absolutely nothing, and there's just a simple acknowledgement of the happening of the moment. So whether somebody is encouraged to do this through 30 years of intense Zen, Zazen practice, or someone goes to satsang with a particular teacher who says, look, let's just acknowledge what's happening in this moment. It doesn't really matter. In both cases, it's a simple acknowledgement of the happening of this moment doing what it does. And some apparent people come to the sense that, oh, all of this is pure awareness or pure consciousness, and others come to the apparent sensibility that this cannot be explained in any way whatsoever. All of them apparently come to the feeling that it's simply happening on its own, that it is a totally spontaneous, uncaused event. So again, it's whatever you are ultimately drawn to, or not even what you're ultimately drawn to, because in this moment, it may seem to be one thing. In another moment, it may seem to be something else. In both cases, it's a totally indefinable event doing what it does. So another person has written in saying, would you please expand on what you have called the story of the watcher? There is such a strong feeling that someone or something is looking out through these eyes. Well, I've just actually given more of an explanation of what I call the story of the Watcher. So hopefully that may offer something to this situation, to this question. This same person has also said, the idea of death and an eternal sleep of nothingness has dogged me all of my life. Many fears seem to track back to this. Obviously, there is a story here that I cannot see as yet. Would you be so kind as to expand on this story? So with this question, what leaps to mind immediately is just memories of some of the old masters, when people would come to them asking, what happens after we die? The master would simply look at the student and say, first of all, explain to me what's been born, and then I'll tell you what's going to happen after that dies. Now, this may seem to be some kind of glib response on the part of that master, but really they're pointing them to the most essential issue here, is that the only apparent experience that anyone fundamentally has of existence is an event that has no form. So, you know, we think of ourselves as a particular body, and yet every one of us knows that that body, when it was apparently in our mother's womb, was about an eighth of an inch long at one point. Then it was a quarter of an inch long. Then it was a foot long. Then it apparently left the womb. It began to grow even further, or seemingly grew further. It was 3 feet high, 4 feet high, 5 feet high. That apparent form, that apparent body, has no particular form. It's always moving and shifting and changing. On any given day, scientists will tell us that the cells in this body are dying and they're apparently replacing themselves. The cells that replace them are never exactly the same because we're obviously getting older. And eventually, this cell structure, this apparent cell structure, will break down and we will apparently die. But actually, all that's been existing in this entire event is a mysterious happening which has no particular form, and that applies to absolutely everything that we know of in existence. So any one of us who have lived life for an apparently long period of time will come to realize that everything is changing. And in fact, at some point, we will end up saying that to somebody. And pretty much every one of our friends will end up saying it to us, that everything is changing. And as we grow older, those apparent changes will become even more apparent. They will seem to happen with increased speed. The changes will be more radical. Certain abilities that we had will disappear. Certain mental abilities that we had will disappear, certain physical abilities that we had will disappear, that we apparently had. Because we never were any particular form, we're simply a portion of this larger event. And yes, it's true that even if you see or relate to this perspective, even if you have this general sense of life, there may still be an underlying sense of wanting to hold things still, of wanting to gain some control, because there is some sense, some low-level sense, that we're somehow separate from this event, when in fact we aren't. We are the event of the universe, the undivided turning. We have never existed as anything apart from that. And then the question becomes, when does the universe die? We don't have a sense that the universe is ever going to die. Even when they speak of the Big Bang Theory and that the universe will collapse in upon itself, they're simply saying that that's just one small portion of the movement of the universe, that prior to the Big Bang, there was some other apparent expression of existence, and after the universe collapses in on itself, it will continue to express itself in some way. It's just that we don't have any sense of what that is. And ultimately, it's just saying that there's no way of conceiving the universe beginning or coming to an end. And we are that. So for an apparent period of time, we appear to be a so-called consciousness in a body, but that's not the truth. And we will apparently move on to be a pinch of dust and a drop of moisture, but that's really not the truth either. It's just simply a totally inexplicable, unformed event doing what it does. It's never becoming anything else. It's always simply a totally inexplicable, formless happening. And that isn't an explanation. It's simply pointing to the happening of now, the event. The moving, shifting, pulsing, warming, cooling, sounding, silencing, pulsing, waving, happening that existence is. Actually, this same person has also added in another message, she went on to say, concurrent with my interest in this teaching is the realization of how much I attempt to stay in control of my health, of my actions, of my emotions, and on and on. It is a knee-jerk kind of thing. Can you speak to this? Yes, there's absolutely nothing wrong with however you're expressed in any particular moment from this so-called non-dual perspective, because never at any moment are you in charge of how you're being expressed. So even if you are relating to this non-dual teaching, so-called teaching, this non-dual perspective, and coming to some sense of simply the movement of existence, the movement of the Great Spirit, the movement of God, the movement of Atman, the movement of the universe, the undivided turning, the flow of nature, the Great Spirit, whatever you want to call it, coming to have more of a sense of that happening, a sense that that is totally indefinable, it has no particular form, that it's simply moving on its own, that in a way you could say it's moving automatically, that it isn't a situation of human beings influencing that in any way, because whatever you are as a human being is already the expression of this Great Spirit or the undivided turning. So whatever physical abilities, mental abilities you have, whatever urges you have, whatever interests, understandings, all of these apparent things that arise, these are all expressions of this larger event. So even if you do have some sense that that's the fact, there may still be a movement to control certain situations. And in fact, I mean, again, this is simply an apparent happening within this indefinable happening. And much of that is totally fine. So if you step out onto a freeway thinking there isn't any traffic coming and a car comes along and you immediately have a knee-jerk reaction to save the body and jump off the freeway, that's the perfect expression of nature doing what it does. So it may seem like you stepping out on the highway, you seeing a car coming and you jumping out of the way, but that's simply the expression of existence, the mysterious expression of nature doing what it does. There is no actual explanation of what that really is. It seems to be a person stepping out on the freeway. It seems to be a person jumping out of the way of a car, and that's fine. There are many situations in life which appear to be human beings trying to control the situation, and even in or even with a non-dual perspective, much of that is still going to occur. So all of it, whether we think it's a person doing it or we don't think it's a person doing it, is simply the unprovoked, spontaneous, automatic flowing of whatever this event is, whatever this happening of life is. And there's no way to actually get someone to relate to that. Even the sense of relating to this perspective is an expression of this event. So It also never apparently expresses itself the same way twice. No two of the apparent expressions in existence are ever identical. So even within this non-dual perspective, you know, you may run across someone expressing this non-dual perspective in a certain way, and you may want to understand it in exactly the way that person understands it, but you can't. Because even if nature expresses you as apparently relating to this non-dual perspective, you will have your own unique sense of things, your own unique sense of it. So, as U.G. Krishnamurti used to say, like, he used to point out that the moment he would say something, that's just being set up to be knocked out of the way by someone else, because no one can have an identical sense of this non-dual perspective. No one can have an exactly identical sense of this inexplicable happening that existence is. The bottom line is that there's a total inability to express what it is. But in the attempts to even say that, it comes out in unique ways in all situations. So I don't know if this is of any interest or support to this particular question, but it's all that's coming up in this moment. So we can move on to the next. Another person has written in asking, is there anything to be done to break free of sometimes life-threatening addictions, or sometimes seriously disabling compulsive disorders, or sometimes debilitating emotional or neurochemical or whatever they are problems, such as severe depression, anxiety, or obsessive rumination and thinking, or from problems like post-traumatic stress disorder or psychosis? Is this non-dual perspective helpful in any way, or does this perspective mean I should do nothing about these things? When you say there is no chance of influencing the flow of existence, do you mean that I should not go to a psychiatrist or work to save the environment because there is no doer and nothing can be done anyway? So again, that's a beautifully expressed question, and it's one of, you know, the most common concerns regarding this perspective. So what is actually being said when from this non-dual perspective, somebody says no human being is influencing existence in any way whatsoever? It's not saying that you shouldn't make any effort in any situation. What it's saying is that if any effort in any apparent direction arises, it's never been anyone's personal doing in the first place. So the bottom line is that there is a totally unexplainable event taking place in this moment, and it is expressing itself. It is not true that human beings have anything to do with making this event happen, because before you had any idea that you were a human being, before you had any idea that you were capable of doing anything, before you had any idea that you seemed to be somebody moving in a certain direction, there was simply this event of existence expressing apparent you. So as an infant, when you were apparently 1 hour old, you weren't planning to do anything. You weren't thinking that you were doing anything. You didn't have any storyline for this event. And yet, you functioned automatically as an expression of nature. I mean, you could say as an expression of nature, or you could say as an expression of this great mysterious event of existence. So-called infants, apparent infants that are 1 hour old, are simply functioning as expressions of the mysterious event that life is. They're not lying there planning their retirement. They're not lying there planning their careers. It'll be a long time, an apparently long time, before the ability to put together that storyline even arises. So these teachings are ultimately saying that in any particular moment, there is only this indefinable event expressing itself. And the storylines that eventually arise, the apparent forms that get focused on, those apparent forms are not the reality because they're all changing, and they're all changing automatically. The labels for those apparent forms are just meaningless sounds. They're just sounds we've agreed to use to point to those apparent forms. So we have apparent forms that don't actually exist because ultimately they're moving and shifting and changing. And we have meaningless sounds that get attached to these forms that don't actually exist. And somehow we get caught up in those stories and believe that those stories are true, when in any event, in any situation, any apparent situation, it is always a totally inexplicable, formless happening, just doing what it does. And anything that we appear to be is an expression of that event. So if we appear to be concerned about a mental disorder or a physical disorder, and there is an urge to explore that through the immediate medical system, the apparent medical system that we find in our apparent culture, all of that is the natural expression of this totally inexplicable formless event. So these teachings are saying there is no particular way for you to behave. In any particular moment, you are the compelled expression of existence. And all of the apparent expressions of existence are unique. Each and every one of us is a unique expression. There is no wrong human being. There is no wrong squirrel. There is no wrong tree. There is no wrong storm. There is no wrong snowflake. Each and every expression of nature is the natural expression of nature. It is one of the legitimate expressions of nature, one of the apparent expressions of nature. All of them are legitimate. And there's no way for me to say what a person should do or shouldn't do, because in each and every moment, certain things will make sense to you, will apparently make sense to you. And they will make sense to you in a way that is somewhat different from each and every other apparent expression. So I could say, in any particular moment, do whatever makes sense to you. And perhaps you'll come to realize that that's always moving and shifting and changing. What makes sense to you today might not make sense to you tomorrow. What you want to explore today, or you seemingly need to explore today, you might not need to explore that a year from now. But you will be expressed in a unique way. And ultimately, this is saying, however you're expressed is fine. Whatever is making sense to you in a particular, or seems to make sense to you in a particular moment, is fine. A non-dual perspective is simply saying, is simply offering some support in acknowledging your own unique expression. However you're expressed, you are a portion, ultimately, you are an expression of this larger, inexplicable, formless dance of existence, the Great Spirit, the undivided turning, Atman, Tao, nature, the Asankhata, whatever label you want to use for it. So we have a couple of questions and comments left here. This one says, "Hi, Daryl. Thanks for the talks and books. I really enjoy listening to and reading your material. I've got a question on mind-altering drugs such as cannabis and LSD. What is your view on these drugs as a tool for awakening and seeing the world from a different perspective?" Well, flat out, from my particular sensibilities, apparent sensibilities, I don't think of mind-altering drugs as any great use in, generally, of any great use in this so-called awakening process. I've got a close friend who was there when Timothy Leary was first gathering people and using LSD as a way of exploring consciousness. And she points out very clearly that in the beginning, it was a very serious exploration of consciousness, but very quickly it fell into a party mode. And the serious exploration of consciousness seemed to go by the wayside. And basically, I mean, from my apparent life journey, I'm a child of the 60s. There were all kinds of things that were happening. I'm not going to go into any personal details of my own particular journey. But mind-altering drugs always create a special situation. And the awakening that many of these apparent spiritual traditions are pointing to, this has nothing to do with special states of mind. It's a simple acknowledgement of your most ordinary, everyday state of mind, as well as any extraordinary state of mind that might arise and pass away, or apparently arise and pass away. The difficulty is that if it's a very exciting, stimulating state of mind that's arising, that somehow the specialness of that apparent experience overrides any kind of general assessment of existence. And so it seems that people are usually on more solid ground if they're just dealing with the most boring, ordinary event of the moment and acknowledging the mysterious, magical dance that that is, rather than trying to run out and find some mysterious magical dancing experience or creating that with a mind-altering drug and then saying, "Ooh, that's pretty neat." Because that's going to fade and you're going to come back to the most ordinary, everyday happenings. And usually people end up saying, "Well, I'd rather have that altered state back." They usually find themselves drawn to that altered state rather than drawn to an acknowledgement of the most ordinary, everyday happening that, in fact, if seen, if acknowledged clearly, if just simply acknowledged for what it is a totally inexplicable, formless, dancing event presenting itself. And then finally, someone else has written in, not so much with a question, but with a comment on her own experience. She writes, "When my mother died, I remember being very struck as I sat with her body by the observation that when certain organs and systems wore out and stopped functioning, the show was over. It is hard to put into words what became evident to me. It was a sense that somehow the whole show was produced entirely by that functioning of the brain, heart, and lungs, all working together, along with everything else. Maybe this is similar to U.G. Krishnamurti saying that it's all a machine. At least I think he said that. It wasn't a scary realization, nor an entirely new realization, and it didn't feel in any way cold or heartless or inhuman or anything like that, as the word machine often evokes. It seems very much a confirmation of the sense that everything is one seamless happening, that what we think of as the soul or the individual essence is just an appearance produced by the functioning. But at the same time, I can't also escape the sense that there is something about life that is not mechanical. Yes, much of it is mechanical, in the sense that it happens automatically in a way that we could say is conditioned or determined by the infinite causes and conditions of nature and nurture. And yet, in this aware presence that is here and now, there is something that is no thing at all that seems not mechanical. It occurs to me that the machine model reduces everything to matter, while the pure awareness model reduces everything to awareness, consciousness, or mind. This seems like an old and false dualistic split, mind versus matter, spiritual versus material. So ultimately this person is just asking if I have any comments regarding those two ways of approaching a description of what's happening in the moment. And I would simply agree with what this person's saying. I mean, from my apparent sense of things, there's no way of saying anything at all about what's happening in this moment. And yet, if an attempt to point to the happening of this moment arises, it will often say that it's happening automatically, like it's one big machine. And yet, even in that, there's the sense that that's not quite right, because it's not like some kind of mechanical device. It's more like an organic dance. And so that it has a certain organic quality to it. And this person who wrote in to comment on this also made reference to this organic sense of things. And so in that organic sense of things, in the flow of nature, we have that sense of life once again being somewhat of a machine, but it's a kind of organic machine, and it has an endlessly creative expression in its apparent forms that seem to be arising and passing in this event. So my only comment on this is that really there's no way of reconciling these views, because the moment we enter a description and attempt to understand existence, we're caught in conflict, because any particular approach will bring up its opposite sense. So if I speak of something mechanical, then I automatically have to be thinking of something organic, because something else that's organic, because something mechanical only makes sense in relation to its opposite. And that's the difficulty of trying to describe existence, or one of the difficulties of trying to describe existence. Ultimately, as all of the apparently great expressions of the mysterious event of existence point out, there's no way of really saying anything at all about what's happening here. It is a totally mysterious, inexplicable happening that doesn't have any form to be described. And the whole thing is happening on its own. Whenever we're dealing with the world of thought, the apparent descriptions that arise and push themselves forward, be very careful, because absolutely none of these descriptions apply to what it is that we would generally say we experience. All of the descriptions are attempting to describe form, and yet every one of us has the experience, if we've apparently lived life to any degree, every one of us has the experience that everything is changing. Whatever this is has no form. Every one of us, if we really consider it, can come to see that the labels we've been given for these apparent forms that don't really exist, these are just meaningless sounds. All they do is point to these apparent forms, and the forms don't actually exist. So our complex storylines about so-called forms ultimately make no sense whatsoever, even though they continue to arise, even when they make no sense whatsoever. They still seemingly arise for us to order a meal in a restaurant or have a conversation with our loved ones. But once it's realized that they make absolutely no sense whatsoever, we no longer look to them to explain existence. Whatever this is can't be explained. There is no way of saying, ultimately, anything at all about what's happening here and now. I can't even say there's something happening here and now. So that brings to an end the questions and comments that have come in through the month of June. Perhaps as a general closing to this session, I might once again just point out that this so-called non-dual sensibility, this so-called non-dual realization, the sense that, or the point, the sense that existence is an undivided dance that can't be explained in any way at all, that sensibility can't be reduced to a battle of who's right and who's wrong. It can't be reduced to ideas of the right view of existence or the wrong view of existence. It can't be reduced to a hierarchy. No one can say that someone is a higher expression of existence than any other person. Everyone is an inexplicable formless event that can't be explained in any way whatsoever. Any apparent person is an inexplicable formless happening that can't be explained in any way whatsoever. In a way, this realization is a validation of absolutely everything that happens. Everything is the natural flow of life living itself. It's the natural expression of the dance of existence, the flow of nature, the natural expression of the Great Spirit, this great unformed swirling event that we call now. The Great Spirit, God, Atman, Tao. Once this happening is realized, and once the realization arises that this cannot be explained in any way whatsoever, it can no longer be reduced to petty squabbles over who is the right expression and who is the wrong expression. It always remains a totally magical parade of ever-changing appearances. This is not an explanation. It's simply pointing to the dance. We're all a portion of the dance, as the Sufis love to say. We're all dancing in God's ballroom. We're all God in drag. And actually, that sounds like a good point to let this go. Again, if you relate to this, wonderful. If you don't relate to this, that's also wonderful.